101.1 FM KFUG Crescent City.
I'll light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today.
You're listening to Counterculture Radio. I'm your host, Dan Schultz. Today we have on again Derek Jensen, our own local celebrity author. You don't mind being called that, do you?
I guess it's one of those things like from the Virginian where as long as you smile when you say it.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm really happy that you're local and I get this nice bonus of living here that we happened upon each other and I get to interview you every once in a while. So, as I told you pre-interview, I've got some good questions. I haven't read all of your books. Shame on me. But the ones that I have read were influential, and I've looked into some of the others and some of the ideas and concepts, and I like the way you talk about the world, although it's not rosy. I think it's really important, especially in our culture where I think in our culture, you're supposed to be happy and rosy, and people are always, especially in California, everyone's afraid to step on someone's toes and they're afraid to offend anybody. But talking about our real problems it just seems healthy to me.
Well, I think years and years ago, I was talking to fisheries biologists about when dams come out. And what happens when a dam will come out is basically they said, like any other flood, that it will cause harm in the short term, but then in the long term, it's beneficial. And she said she thinks about this, you know, rivers, we misdefine rivers entirely, and that they're not static. And if you look at them over time, they writhe across the landscape like snakes. They dance. And every time a river changes its course, she said she would always get really sad for the frogs and the fish and the insects and the trees who were killed by the change of course. But then she would also be happy because this is part of the river's lifestyle and part of what makes a river. And so she used this phrase that really stuck with me, which is every time there's the huge flood and the river changes course, it causes short-term habitat loss and long-term habitat gain. And when she said that, it really struck me that this is a really useful metaphor for a lot of things in our life. Why do so many people stay in bad relationships? It's because they're afraid of the short-term loss for the long-term gain. And why do they stay in jobs they don't like? It's they're afraid of the short-term loss for the long-term gain. And so the way this ties back to the feeling positive is that I think, you know, especially with things being so bad environmentally, there's this notion that if you really start to accept how bad things are, that you have to go around being unhappy all the time. But there's a couple things. One of them is that there's a doctor friend of mine always says that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And I just read something else. And you know, you're seeing right now why my books are nonlinear because I jump all over the place. But I just read this thing the other day. I was looking up some for whatever reason. This is the great thing about being a writer is you can look up whatever you want and you usually have an excuse for it. And for example, a few months ago I was stuck in San Francisco and I had always wondered what snot is. And so I looked up what snot, which is not going to be the story here, but the snot story is actually kind of interesting too because it ends up that that our bodies are so amazing. What snot is essentially is complex sugars that and proteins mixed into this sort of goo that basically when a bacteria or a virus or anybody else, any foreign body enters you, this is your first line of defense. And so they make it really sticky and gooey and basically pillowy so that it takes forever for the bacteria to chew its way through. And by the time it's chewed through the first layer of snot, there's another layer. And it's an extraordinary, extraordinary creation. Anyway, so leaving that aside, that's one of the weird things I get to look up. So the thing I was looking up the other day was for whatever reason, rates of suicide. And one of the things I found out is that I was wondering what the rate of suicide is of people who have, terminal cancer. Cause I was thinking about different reasons people kill themselves. And I saw this really interesting thing, which is people who mistakenly believe they have cancer have a higher rate of suicide attempts than people who actually do have terminal cancer. And that really struck me, and it really struck me because, I mean, there could be lots of other reasons for this, but one of the things that hit me is you get this, you fear this terrible diagnosis, and you're so afraid to go into the doctor to find out if it's real that it seems easier to just skip the whole process when what you should do is get information first.
Yeah.
And, you know, there could be many other reasons going on. They don't mean to project too far into this, but I just thought that was very interesting. And so back to the question of facing difficult situations. I mean, sure, I like to have friendly conversations, and I'm as much conflict avoidant as the next person, but there are times and places where it really is important to face the situation that we're in and to attempt to do something about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm not conflict resistant at all. In fact, I've come to really enjoy meeting any difficult situation head on, or oftentimes I think our conflict resistance is oftentimes in our own emotions. You know, we just don't have the tools to express we don't even know what we feel. But it seems to me that in all of those realms, or in all the realms, that to the degree that you face the problem head on, does take some courage sometimes, something always good comes from it. If you express that your shame or your pain, then there's always a healing there. And you know, as it relates to, you know, we're going to talk about the environment and all of these problems that humanity has, unless we talk about them, unless we face them and say, you know, even our feelings about them, how can we allow for healing if we don't address it? It one comes from the other. And I just, in my own personal life and professional life, that I actually enjoy confronting the problems, even at a party. You know, somebody comes to the party and everybody's always happy and they're, oh, how you doing? Great. I'm not even sure I want to hear how great people are, but it does seem way more real for me to hear, hey, what are your challenges right now? What are you going through? You know what I mean?
Yeah. That, yeah, I have a, yeah, I have sort of a complex response to that I'm not sure how well I can articulate. And that's so this will be good that we're planning on doing a number of interviews, because what's going to happen. See, here's the deal too, is one reason, like when I'm doing a talk, the people will ask questions during Q&A, and usually I've got the answer right immediately. And people think I'm a lot smarter than I actually am, because the truth is that I've been asked this question 50 times before.
Uh-huh.
And so the first 10 times I was like, huh, wow, that's a pretty interesting question. And then 4 weeks later, you know, I'll be walking somewhere and some sort of answer will come to me. And it's the same here, that I have a really complex response to what you said that I don't know that I can really articulate right now.
Well,
but I think
okay.
I agree with what you're saying. And then I also, I don't know, part of what I'm thinking also is that, I have been a question that I've gotten a lot more than I would have thought I would over the years is, so what do you talk about at Thanksgiving with, you know, like family get togethers or something?
Uh-huh.
And the truth is I usually end up talking about football, because I can't tell you how many Thanksgiving dinners over the decades I've ruined by Yeah. You know, talking about genocide against indigenous peoples.
Exactly.
It's like, so Derek, would you say grace? It's like, sure.
Yeah.
Let's thank the indigenous peoples for the theft of their land. Let's thank, you know, let's thank the turkey for living this horrible, miserable life in this factory farm. It's like, oh, can somebody please shut Derek up? And so that's why it's a little bit of a complex response. I completely agree. I think that there are times and places for it. You know, that's all I'm saying. And I completely agree with you in general. It's just that there are also times where let's just make nice for a little while so that, you know, so that the family that we actually only see once a year, you know, doesn't end up at blows.
Right. And this is a good time and place to do it because we're not forcing it on anybody. They have to go and, they can turn the channel on the radio or they can, click off the YouTube,
Oh yeah. In this case, I completely agree. We absolutely need to face what's going on. Have you been down to, the wharf lately, or have you been down to any of the tide pools? The starfish are gone.
No, I have
all
not.
All along the Pacific Northwest, there's been 99% or more, starfish. There's this horrible disease they're getting that they're ripping themselves apart. They're dying and 99%, mortality.
Do you think this is a Fukushima thing?
Nobody knows. There are some rumors it's Fukushima, but I actually don't think it is. And one reason I don't think it is it's also happening some on the East Coast. Uh-huh. And I think that I think it's global warming. And I think it's, some sort of, I'm making this up. I'm not a starfish expert. What I know is that it comes on really fast. There were places in Oregon that were fine as of January, February, and by May, 99% of the starfish were gone.
Wow.
And, so we are facing a very, very serious situation. I go back to what my doctor friends always say about the first step toward diagnosis is, first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And can you imagine a doctor-patient relationship where they acted like we do with environmentalism, where, like, I can't tell you how many essays over the years I've been asked to write by editors who say, okay, I want you to write about the apocalypse, but then I want you to end on a happy note.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, so the doctor, here's the bad news. The bad news is you have emphysema, you have this other, you've got liver failure, you've got this. But the good news is that we're going to cheerlead. You know, it's like I understand the need for – I don't understand how we can possibly come up with solutions unless we face the situation that we're in firmly. And this is true not just with that, but it's also true with abusive relationships. You know, there are so many people who stay in abusive relationships because of – you know, I was reading this years and years ago. I got some literature on AIDS from a friend of mine who was HIV positive. This is back, 25 years ago. And one of the sentences from the literature he sent me just blew me away, which is, eliminate false hope. And I love that line. We need to ruthlessly eradicate false hopes. And false hopes bind us to unlivable situations. They blind us to real possibilities. You know, one of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father, he's extremely violent. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He broke my sister's arm. He beat my mom. He beat my other sister. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And one of the reasons my mother stayed with him was because there weren't any battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. So her options were extremely limited. Yeah. Another reason she stayed with him is because of the false hope that he would change. And I think about this in the larger scale. Do you remember 2007? A lot of people were saying, gosh, if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things will be okay.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's we get this. What are the false hopes? You know, the false hope that BP is suddenly going to act differently. The false hope that you can continue to burn fossil fuels and not cause global warming. The false hope, you know, that there's all these just crazy false hopes that I think need to be eradicated both in our personal and social lives. Except, and here's the deal. I want to say this, but I have a caveat like I usually do, which is, you know, I used to teach at the prison, and I think that if someone honest to goodness is a prisoner, then there is a reason for false hope. If you are in a situation that you are in some ways powerless, I think that there can be some there can be coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
That may be necessary to help you survive in that situation. But if you're not actually powerless, if you can actually leave, then I think you need to get rid of the false hopes. Oh, and I want to say one more thing about this, which is that, you know, I've bashed hope for years. And at one talk I was doing, people in the audience shouted out, what is your definition of hope? And it's like, oh my gosh, I don't know. So I asked them for a definition and they came up with a great definition, which is hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Cause I think the problem is not just false hope, but hope itself. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. And people say, oh gosh, Derek, don't you want to think positive things about the future? And that's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is figure out where you do and don't have agency. And a great example is the next time I get on a plane, I hope it doesn't crash. Because once it's in the air, I've got no agency. It either crashes or it doesn't. I got nothing to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I'm not going to sit here right now and say, I hope that I have some food in a little while. You know, I'm just going to eat. And a great example of this is this one woman came up to me one time and she said her brother has cancer. And she said, are you telling me I can't hope that my brother doesn't die of cancer? I said, no, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that if he is lying sick on the floor, you can't stand there with car keys in your hand and say, I hope you make it to the hospital.
Right.
So the important thing, when we say we hope that salmon survive, what we're saying is we have no agency. If we're saying we hope that global warming doesn't kill the planet, we are saying we have no agency. And I'm not really interested in that. What I'm interested in is figuring out what we can do and what we can't do.
Right. It seems to me that hope also strongly implies that someone else is going to do something, but it's not going to be me.
Exactly. Yeah. And that can be very true. This person wrote to me one time saying, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but, you know, you can – like we can't just allow dams to stay and hope that the salmon survive. But on the other hand, if you do remove the dams, as I hope happens – hope, there we go. Hope happens soon on the Klamath. Then at that point, we have to hope that the salmon accept this offering of the river back and they do what they do. But we can't, but that's out of our control. What is in our control is whether the dam is standing or not. What is not in our control is how the salmon respond to the dam being removed.
Derek, if you had to boil down one, maybe you can't do it in one, but I think I know your answer to this question. If you had to boil down one element of our culture, of the fabric of our society, that is the fundamental a cause of our undoing, what would it be? I think your answer would be violence.
Oh, no, it actually wouldn't.
Okay, good.
Well, do you want me to give my answer or do you want me to talk about violence? I can do both. I can do it whichever order you want or need.
I'd just like to hear your, what do you think it boils down to, the fundamental problem?
Well, I'm just finishing a book on human supremacism, which I think is the biggest problem. The fundamental belief that humans are fundamentally separate from or superior to everybody else.
Yes. Okay. That's actually my answer. My answer to the problem of all of our human ills is, I would define it as separation. Us being separate from nature, us being separate from each other or God or whomever.
Yeah. So many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that, indigenous peoples have across the world have generally believed that the world consists of other beings to enter into relationship with and not resources to be exploited.
Right.
And, you know, like I said, I'm just about done with this book. And part of the reason I started it is because I was looking at the notions, you know, all of the notions for why humans are superior, are tautological. And tautological means that you use the thing to define itself. A joke I heard about tautology is the first rule of the Fight Club is the first rule of the Fight Club.
Yeah.
And so one of the things is, you know, we have fairly large brains. So we say that large brains are a sign of intelligence. And we say that then this form of intelligence is why we're superior. But it's pretty interesting because it ends up that, you know, of course, whales have much larger brains than we do, and walruses have brains about the same size as ours. But then they say, okay, well, it's not just brain size. What it is brain size to body mass ratio. Well, there's an interesting thing about that, which is the brain size to body mass ratio of humans is about 2.5%, which is the same as what it is for mice. And songbirds have about 8%. Shrews actually have the largest brain size to body mass ratio of anybody, about 10%. Oops. You know, so what we do, see, the thing is, what we do is at that point we go, oh my gosh, well, that can't be the determinant, can it? So what we do is we keep making these moving targets. You know, they say language was supposed to be the thing that separated humans, which is just nonsense. For one thing, you know, there are bonobos and chimpanzees and great and gorillas who can speak American Sign Language. And I'm sorry, how many of these scientists can speak ape? You know, which one's actually bilingual? Mm-hmm. But in addition, they've recently been – did we talk before about – plant language?
Well, we touched on that, yes.
Yeah, it's the coolest thing. I probably talked about it because I've been writing about it. It's just, they're doing a dictionary. This guy, Stefano Mancuso, is trying to make a dictionary, and plants speak through chemical languages. And so far, he's been able to decode, he thinks, about 3,000 to 4,000 different words that they use. And I just interviewed a guy not very long ago about who's been studying prairie dog language. And his argument is that he's been doing it for 30 years, that prairie dogs have a language at least as complex as whales. Very, very interesting stuff. Anyway, so we're not really that special. And the belief that we're special is I think, a big part of the problem. Because what we do is we're wanting to define ourselves as special so that we can have the excuse to exploit. Because if we're better than everybody else, that means it doesn't really matter if they disappear.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's, you know, I read a little bit about some of your earlier works, and you, I guess you don't like to be labeled as an anarcho-primitivist. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I got three problems with it. One of them is anarcho, one of them is primitive, and one is ist. So yeah, I don't like it. The ist part is I have some trouble with labels in general, but we'll just set that aside.
Yeah. Okay.
The primitive part is that they it's the word primitive has been used to apply to indigenous peoples, and I don't think that they're primitive at all. And I think the word's really shockingly racist. And I find it extraordinary that basically a bunch of white anarchists who call themselves anarcho-primitivists say they're trying to reclaim this word, but they're not indigenous peoples. You know, if the indigenous people wanted to try to, quote, reclaim that word, that could be a discussion they would have. I don't think it'd be a very good idea, but that's none of my business because I'm not indigenous. But I think it's really ridiculous for white people to be trying to reclaim a pejorative word on behalf of an oppressed class. That would be like white people trying to reclaim pejorative words for members of other classes. It's just crazy. And there's other problems I have with it too.
So you are okay as far as labels go, with being associated with the word indigenous. Yes?
If indigenous is defined as one who is an ally to indigenous peoples, then sure.
Yeah.
Kind of like I don't mind being labeled as a pro-feminist, because I align myself with feminists. It's kind of like the hope thing. I'm not a hope fascist, and likewise I'm not a label fascist. I don't mind being called a writer. Don't mind being called an environmentalist. You know, there are some that are okay. But I don't like primitivists. And also the anarcho thing. I finished a book a while ago that's going to come out next year on some of the problems in anarchism. And, you know, I always thought anarchism just meant, somebody
like
who thinks, well, yeah. And somebody who believes that states are inherently oppressive. And that's a discussion we can have. And I certainly believe that states are inherently oppressive, and laws are made for the most part by and for those in power. But one of the places that I I have been kicked out of the Anarchy Club many times because I say things like, I believe that it is, I don't have a problem with laws or taboos or anything else against rape. And if you can believe it, I've actually gotten in trouble with anarchists with that. They've completely freaked out because I'm attempting to constrain their freedom. And it ends up that anarchism is, this is one of the reasons I don't call myself an anarchism. There have been very strong, some of the major anarchists have been pedophiles, and they've used their ideology of liberation and of having autonomous zones in order to perpetrate the sexual exploitation of members of oppressed classes like children or women. And there has been almost no response among the anarchist community to that except support and for the behavior. In fact, both major U.S. anarchist magazines through the 1990s were militantly pro-pedophile. And
see, isn't that just the problem, though, Derek, is that whether you're talking about communism or capitalism or anarchist or socialism or any ism or ists or it isn't the real problem human consciousness? It seems like we screw all those things up.
Well, the
because, you know, the idea of anarchist being that you don't have a hierarchy or that you're free to create, you know, it doesn't seem like a bad idea. And for that matter, although I do have some problems with capitalism, socialism or communism sound like perfectly great ideas, but when you, that's in the lab, on the ivory tower. But when you actually give it to people, then human consciousness screws it all up and corrupts it.
Well, I think that that is true within the dominant culture to a certain degree. I keep thinking about this study that was done by Ruth Benedict as to why some cultures are good, to use her term, or why some are not good. Some treat women well, treat children well. There's not a lot of war, not a lot of competition. And it all comes down to one thing, which is those cultures recognized that humans are both social and selfish. And what they did is they destroyed the bifurcation between altruism and selfishness by socially rewarding behavior that benefits the group as a whole and disallowing behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group. And so you can have a culture where the poor treatment of women is rewarded, and you're going to get the poor treatment of women. If poor treatment of women is not rewarded, is in fact disallowed, then you will have different behavior. And so we all know the name Hugh Hefner. He has become incredibly rich through the sexual exploitation of women. And that is part of the problem with the culture, is that the reward system. And what Ruth Benedict found in the studies, in the culture she studied, was that it really came down to how a culture handled wealth. That if it handled wealth through what she called a siphon system, whereby wealth is constantly siphoned from rich to poor, then everybody's fairly secure. And I'll give an example of this in a second. And if, on the other hand, it's handled through a funnel system like capitalism, where wealth is constantly funneled from everybody to the rich, then everybody's in competition and everybody treats everybody else more poorly. And a great example of this would be that if I go fishing and I catch a bunch of fish and then I just hold them for myself, then in a good culture, I would be socially ostracized for doing that. I would be considered terrible. On the other hand, if I catch a bunch of fish and then I give them to everybody in the community, then everybody thinks I'm great. And the reason I can give the fish away is because I know tomorrow you're going to go out and gather a bunch of huckleberries and you're going to distribute those. And so what we're building is social capital, and we're building relationships as opposed to building capital, as opposed to accumulation. And if you have the entire culture working that way, everybody's going to be much more secure. The problem is, A, I can't do that in this culture, because if I give everything away today, how am I going to pay rent tomorrow? It only works if everybody's doing it. And the other problem with it is that what happens when a culture like that encounters a culture like the dominant culture that has instead been using instead of living in a forest, as the Tala did here for at least 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science, if you believe the myths of the Tala lived just since the beginning of time, without trashing the place, when they encounter something like the dominant culture that has instead been destroying land bases and converting them into weapons of war, then they're going to get conquered. And that's pretty much a problem that we have, is that we can have all these good cultures, but then when they encounter, they have to figure out ways to deal with sociopaths. And yeah, to take this all the way back to anarchism in the first place, my problem with anarchism is not just that there are pedophiles within anarchism, because there's pedophiles in Little League, you know, I mean, Little League coaches, there's pedophiles all over the place. My problem is that the ideology is used to support the pedophilia. You know, at least the Catholic Church, as horrible as it is, has the tiny, tiny amount of grace to acknowledge that pedophilia is actually bad. And I haven't seen that happen in anarchism. And I know that this is attacking sort of a sacred cow, but it's like, okay, the book is going to get published by Seven Stories. And the publisher there was saying, he said to me, gosh, you know, I'm an anarchist and my father's an anarchist, and I'm really concerned, like, about the pedophilia stuff. You talked about, you know, how Anarchy, A Journal of Desire, Armed, and Fifth Estate, the two major U.S. anarchist magazines, how they came out in favor of pedophilia. Can't you find some anarchists talking against it? And I said, you find them for me and I will quote them. That's the point, is that anarchism has completely failed to, not only completely failed to address pedophilia within anarchism, it has been militantly supportive of it. And so that's really, really messed up. And so there's a bunch of other problems too. But anyway, that's my thing with anarchism. I agree with you that I don't agree that human consciousness always messes things up. What I think is that human consciousness within the framework of the dominant culture, with its libertarianism and with its complete lack of any knowledge of what it means to live in a community, and with its basis in various forms of supremacism, whether they are human supremacism, white supremacism, male supremacism, everything is going to be tainted by that and destroyed by that. I completely agree with that part. All I can say, all I know for sure, and I'm not saying the Tala were perfect. I don't know a lot. I know some about them, but I don't know a ton about them. But what I do know for a fact is they lived here for 12,500 years without destroying the place. I know the Talawa lived here sustainably.
Yeah.
And I know that we can say the same for the Yurok and the Hupa. And
I mean, the native cultures, they had their violence and they had their wars. And so, yeah, like you said, they're not perfect, but sometimes I don't know. I feel like we're in a war. Well, you speak to this, that we're in a war against our culture, this Western culture. And, you know, in your books, you talk about, like in Welcome to the Machine, you talk about the Western obsession with control and you talk about lifestyleism and critique of cosmeticism. And there's all kinds of these cultural things. And I think that maybe what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the aspects of the indigenous people and their connection to nature and their respect and reverence for life is really what you identify and connect with. Is that correct?
Well, I think that that's really important, and I think that we can all have it. And I'm also, I'm really uncomfortable, and I'm doing this, I'm not blaming you. I'm really uncomfortable that you and I, as two white dudes, are having this conversation when we live in the context, when we're living on stolen Talawa land. And maybe the thing to do would be to ask the Talawa.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that would be, I would enjoy doing that. We should have a round table discussion with me and you and a Talawa, elder and find out what their answer is.
Sure. I think that it's very important to listen to the people who have lived here since time began.
Yeah. Yeah, I know surprisingly little about their ideas and I guess, you know, I've read books and I maybe met a few, but I don't know it intimately. I guess it's a journey for me. I want to know it intimately and maybe I'm discovering it in my own ways. But, you know, in what ways are you actively seeking, besides writing about it, in your life, are there ways that you're actively connecting to those ideas?
To which ideas?
The ideas of reverence for life and this lack of separation, this connection to nature, in a personal way. How do you go about living that?
Well, there's two things. One is that you know, I just, they're my neighbors, just like any other neighbors, and I spend time with them every day. By them, I mean just the local trees, the alders, the dragonflies, and so on. And that's part of it. And another part is that it's really clear to me that, you know, there's an environmentalist friend of mine often says that the reason he does the work he does is because we can't predict the future. And so if grizzly bears are still around in 20 years, they may still be around in 100. But if they're gone in 20, they'll be gone forever. And if bull trout are still around in 20, they may be around in 100. And so one of the things I do is, I mean, by paying attention, it's the first thing to do is to pay attention. There's this phrase called declining baselines. That is, well, I'm going to back up a second. A few years ago, I read that migratory songbird populations on the east coast of the United States had collapsed by about many species, 40 to 80% in the last 40 years. And I was freaking out about that until I realized that 40 years ago was still after Silent Spring, which means that they'd already collapsed through pesticides by 40 to 80%. And then they probably collapsed prior to that with the introduction of agriculture by 48 to 80%, urbanization. So these are collapses upon collapses. And there's a phrase for that called declining baselines, which is where you come to accept whatever the current reality is. You come to accept this new baseline of how bad things are without, and you forget that this is not normal.
Yeah,
and this happens in all areas of our lives. It can certainly happen in relationships. It has happened with surveillance that I've read about in the 1930s, how people were freaked out that people were going to get social security numbers because here is a number that will follow you from cradle to grave. And for crying out loud, I wish that that's all we had to worry about in terms of surveillance, you know, was a number at this point. But the same thing is happening like dragonflies. I don't know how many people who are listening to this have noticed how much dragonflies have collapsed in the last 10 years. That I used to see, there's a pond right near here, and I used to see 100 dragonflies in the air at a time, and now I see maybe 10. The Pacific tree frogs 10 years ago would be so loud that you couldn't have a human conversation outside at night, but they're getting much quieter. And there are sow bugs. Daddy long legs, those little tiny blue butterflies. I used to see hundreds of them, and I see maybe three a year now. And so one of the things I've done, and this is something I think everybody should do, and this is not sufficient, but it's a first step, is I think everybody should start keeping little calendars or little diaries of who they see, because that's one of the ways we can stop the baseline from declining is by recognizing the losses. And then that's the first step, is to recognize the losses. And the second step is to do something about it. And in my own case, I went out, and this is just a great example. Anybody can do this. That, and this is not me being so great. Once again, this is something anybody can do. And the big distinction, by the way, is not between those who want to resist militantly and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing at all. So this is just a way to get off your behind and do something. But what I noticed is that the pond out here, a lot of the frog eggs were dying from this mold. I saw that they were covered with little white fuzz. And so I looked up what that is, and it's something called saprolegnia. And this mold is ubiquitous. It's not the mold's fault. The mold's job is to clean up the weakened egg sacs. And then I noticed, or then I started looking at this more, and I found out that the reason this mold is coming on more is because the ozone layer being weakened, UVB weakens some of the egg sacs. So the weakened ozone layer allows more UVB through. UVB weakens some of the egg sacs. So as an experiment, I started bringing in some of the egg sacs when they were just after they're laid into my kitchen. And because UVB won't go through glass, I would raise them out in the kitchen and then put them back in the pond. And I've been really trying to help this way. And this is completely insufficient to the problems we face, but it's one thing that I can do, and it's one thing I have done, and it's one thing I continue to do, is I bring the eggs in, hatch them out, and release them. And I probably do, as soon as they're hatched, I let them go. And I probably do, I don't know, a couple, 3,000 eggs a year. And that's just a drop in the bucket, but it's something. And so the first step is for people to notice that something is different. And like I was talking to one person who lives in the same neighborhood, I asked them if they had noticed the frogs are much quieter. And this one person said, no, I haven't noticed at all. And the only way you could not notice is if you never went outside. And so that's the first thing, is to notice the difference. And the second thing is to ask this other, what do you need? You know, I don't know what to do about the tiny blue butterflies. I miss them terribly, but I don't know what to do about them. I do know what I can do about these particular eggs. There's a lot less newts, too. Used to be tons of rough-skinned newts. There's not many. And I don't know how to help that. But the things I do know how to help, I do. And so that's the thing, is find what you can do and then do something. That's how, and I don't do it simply to reconnect. I do it, you know, my mom is elderly, and every day over the past month, I'm done now, but every day over the past month, I would carry in a few loads of firewood for her. She ordered firewood, got it dumped in her driveway, and then I would carry it in for her. And this is not a way for me to connect with my mom. It's just what you do for somebody you care about. And it's the same with this, that I care about the frogs and they're in trouble, so I'm going to do something. So that's, and then there's also the larger question of how do we stop terrible projects from going through? And that's another question that you and I can talk about. This is a problem that the left has had that is terrible, is the right wing has been extraordinary at organizing and getting all sorts of things pushed through. You know, the whole political process is really corrupt, but that doesn't alter the fact that sometimes good or bad things can happen. And I think that we on the left need to get better, much better, at running for local offices and for organizing and for opposing terrible things.
Yeah. Now, Derek, our time is going all too fast, and I have 30 something questions, and we're going to get only a small fraction of them. And one of the things that I'm interested in right now, I see this right now as a pivotal time in history. And I don't know if you've seen any of my recent interviews, but I have interviewed Jim Willey and John Rubino and Andy Hoffman and people who are, you know, in the financial world. And we are, it appears to me that we are coming upon a time of great change in the economic world. And I wonder sometimes, what, it's like a race to see who can beat who to the punch. Like, who's going to end the system? Is it going to be environmental collapse? Is it going to be economic collapse? Some of the events in Europe and Asia, So the things that our government are doing, I am suspecting are leading to world war. You know, the effects of Fukushima, some people say the Pacific Ocean has 5 years. Where do you see this going? Are the meek going to inherit the earth? Or do you suspect that there's a possibility that either the meek inherit the earth or people actually wake up because things get really bad? Or do you see an Orwellian future? If in your imagination, how do you see things playing out?
Well, my loyalty is always to the real physical world, and my hope, if I can use that word, is that the economic system collapses before the world completely collapses.
Yes.
And I have been, I must admit, disappointed in the form that the 2008 collapse has really taken, in that it has not really destroyed the worst parts of the economy, but all it has done is the same thing as what this economy generally does, which is make life harder for the middle and lower classes, and the rich are doing very well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And so I don't... All I know for sure is that if we continue on the path we're on, we're going to get to where we're going, which is complete biotic collapse. And I don't see the majority of people, what I don't see is a voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living. I see people more concerned about off-road vehicle access than I do about survival of the real world. And
you asked that question in the end game. Do you believe that this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? But do you think that the number of people who are willing to make that voluntary choice is growing?
Yeah, I think it's growing, but one of the problems is that I don't think it's growing. I think the numbers themselves are growing. I'm not sure that they're particularly growing faster than the population at large. I'm not sure we're becoming a greater percentage. And here's another problem. Okay, here's what I see, honestly. What I see in the mid to short term, or no, sort of short to mid term, like the next 5 to 7 years, is I see increasingly open fascism in the United States.
Yes.
And this is something I wrote about in Culture Make Believe, that when there are economic collapses, what you often see is people going at each other's throats. And you often see a turn toward fascism and a loss of the civil rights gains by members of various oppressed groups. And so immediately after the Civil War, American Civil War, when you had the enslaved peoples becoming free, you also had the rise of the KKK. You had a dramatic increase in lynchings post American Civil War. And then you see in the 1920s with the German collapse really leading to the rise of fascism in Germany. And at the same time in the United States, in the late teens, early 20s, I think it was Warren G. Harding was actually sworn into president with a KKK Bible. And so there was this rise in fascism in the United States at that point too. And we're seeing that again today. And that I find really both predictable and troubling. And so, I think that is something that we can, as best we can, prepare for. And one of the ways we can prepare for that is by attempting to inoculate ourselves and those around us from this fascism by making our allegiance with victims of this culture absolute. So
well, we're all victims of this culture.
Well, we are all victims of the culture, but there are some who are more victims than others. And as a white male in his early 50s, I'm not going to argue that I am as much of a victim of this culture as an African-American female. And I don't have that history of oppression against me. And so anyway, back to the original point, what do I see? I don't know. I'm not very optimistic at all. And the reason I continue doing the work is a couple reasons. One is because I'm in love. And if you love the land, then you act, if you love anybody, you act to defend your beloved when they're under threat. And the other reason I keep working is because the stakes are so high. There are stolid scientists who are saying the oceans could be devoid of fish within 35 years. The oceans. This culture has gotten so powerful that it has the capacity to actually destroy the oceans. And the stakes are so high that if there is a 1/1,000,000th of 1% chance that anything I do can make any difference, I gotta do it. And so, you know, failure is not an option. Giving up is certainly not an option. So do I have a lot of optimism for the future? No. And frankly, less each day. The one thing that does give me some optimism is how desperately life wants to live. You know, when I see, cities, when I see like parts of Detroit are being taken over again by trees, you know, or when I see that, yes, it's irradiated, but when I see that there are wolves back at Chernobyl, or when I see, you know, when I see even weeds coming up through sidewalk, you know, life really wants to live. And this culture really wants to destroy life, which is a whole nother subject we could talk about. But that's the race, is between this omnicidal culture and life itself wanting to live. And, you know, every little bit we can add our voices and our lives and our muscles and every part of us to the side wanting to live is that much we can possibly make it so there is some. And if we can add our prayers to, you know, no matter how you define prayers, to the good side, you know, then there's that much better chance that there's all sorts of tipping points that have been reached for global warming. They're just terrifying. And there's all sorts of, you know, it used to be believed that one unit of pollution caused one unit of damage. That's not how it works at all. What they now understand is that, you can have that a lake or a forest or a river will be fairly resilient up to a point, but then it tries to hold things together. And then when it reaches a certain point, it entirely collapses. And what we need to do is to keep it from getting to that point. If we keep it, it's like a body, you know, your body, I could stab you. I'm not going to, this is not me being hostile to you. You know, I can stab you once and you can survive. I can stab you twice and you can survive and you can heal. But once I stab you 15 times at some point, 15th time, 16th time, 7th, you know, at one of those, it's going to be fatal. And so your body's going to keep trying. And so what we need to do is both heal. I mean, that's the thing is that's the great thing about everything being so messed up, but no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. If people want to work on healing, that's great. If people want to work on transformation, that's great. If people want to work on stopping the damage, you know, stopping Caltrans, stopping whatever horrible thing is being done, that's great. You know, there's work for all of us, because what we've got to do is we've got to stop this before it puts that last knife jab into the body.
Yeah. Yeah, and I want to spend some time on talking about solutions or our efforts anyways. It might not solve, or it might. Sometimes it seems to me I don't care. Well, I shouldn't say I don't care. That I'm detached from the outcome. That it's enough that, you know, to live a purpose-driven life, where I'm doing something good, that my karma is checking out with the world, and fighting the good fight is deeply satisfying, even in the midst you know, of suffering. But I have one more question before we go. We only have 3 or 4 more minutes, Derek. Are you familiar with Charles Eisenstein's work, Sacred Economics?
Yeah.
You know, one of the concepts that is interesting in that about this abstraction of money as opposed to, you know, the indigenous peoples who had, potlatch. Isn't that it? Potlatch?
Yeah, some of the people in the Pacific Northwest had those.
Yeah, potlatch is what it's called. Or just like you were saying, you have a bunch of fish and you give them out and you have this sharing, this whole competitive model as opposed to the cooperative model. And I'm interested in a life without money. Even as I imagine a life without money, it changes my consciousness. And I'm hoping actually this fall of the economic system changes our mind and our concepts, even the paradigms, as Charles Eisenstein talks about, of getting away from this money abstraction and being into real things. And I, you know, maybe your mother needs firewood and I have a bunch of it and you guys have, chicken eggs and, you know, wow, it seems like that changes the fabric of life. Do you think that's possible?
I don't think that that's possible I think it's possible on a very small scale within the current system because, you know, I can certainly make exchanges with my neighbors, but in terms of, I think the whole system is so entrenched that it needs to be destroyed before these others can come out.
Yes.
And that's actually the whole money thing is an interesting topic for another time that we often think that money was created to facilitate barter, but that's actually not true at all. Money was created in the first place to facilitate taxation and slavery. It emerged coterminous with those. Anyway, that's a very whole another topic. But yeah, the problem is that we can make whatever small changes we want, and that's all fine. But the larger system is still killing the entire planet. Yeah. And that's the thing that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, well, there's so much to talk about, and I'm interested in furthering the conversation. We're out of time for now, so I just want to thank you for writing your books and doing your work and having this conversation on Counterculture Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for all your work, too. I think it's really important. I look forward to doing this again. That you're born today.